This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Portland, Oregon appeared to have a quiet night Sunday after 100 days of protests since the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. There were no reports on local media of demonstrations downtown or in southeast Portland where violent clashes with police took place late Saturday and early Sunday morning. Hundreds of people gathered for rallies and marches Saturday night, as often violent demonstrations that have happened nightly since Floyd hit the 100-day mark. Molotov cocktails thrown in the street during a march sparked a large fire and prompted police to declare a riot. Police confirmed that tear gas was deployed to defend themselves and said 59 people were arrested, ranging in the age from 15 to 50. The mayor of Rochester, New York, says reforms are coming to the police department as community elders seek to bring calmer minds to a fifth night of demonstrations over the March death of Daniel Prude. He lost consciousness after police held a hood over his head. Mayor Lovely Warren announced that the crisis intervention team would move from the police department to the city's Department of Youth and Recreation Services during a news conference on Sunday. The police chief, LaRon Singletary, said he supports the need for reform and is now working with experts and clinicians in getting services for people with mental health issues that bring them into repeated police contact. More than 1,000 protesters gathered for the march. India has crossed the coronavirus tally of Brazil with 4.2 million cases. It became the second worst-hit country on a day when urban metro trains partially resumed service in the capital. More than 90,000 cases have been added to India's caseload within a 24-hour period. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. As powerful typhoon damaged buildings, flooded roads, and knocked out power to thousands of homes in South Korea after battering southern Japanese islands, the Korean forecasters warned of heavy rain and wind as the typhoon made landfall, but it is expected to later weaken to a tropical storm. Cars struggled to navigate flooded roads in coastal cities, and more than 1,600 residents were evacuated due to the possibility of landslides and other concerns. Haishin plowed through Okinawa and other southern Japanese islands over the weekend. One person was slightly injured in Busan, and Japanese officials said at least 20 people were injured, and NHK Public TV said 4 people were missing. Almost 300 Rohingya Muslims were found on a beach in Indonesia's Aceh province Monday and were evacuated by military police and the Red Cross volunteers. The group arrived from one boat and were given shelter and other assistance. Another boat of 94 hungry, weak Rohingya had been found off Aceh in June. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have fled Buddhist-majority Myanmar due to a military crackdown, and many live in densely crowded refugee camps in Bangladesh. Rights activists fear large numbers of Rohingya have gone to sea, fleeing ongoing persecution in Myanmar and hardship in the camps in Bangladesh, where traffickers may promise the refugees a better life abroad. In Mexico, feminist groups and family members of missing persons continued to occupy the office of the National Human Rights Commission Sunday as they called on the government to take more action to combat gender-based violence and locate missing persons. The building was initially occupied by missing persons' family members and advocates Thursday, and on Friday, feminist groups joined that protest. On Sunday, one activist knocked down the lettering at the office's entrance while others hoisted a sign over the exterior reading Occupied House of Refuge. Activists have placed a barricade in front of the building and hung posters and information of missing persons from windows and balconies. Mexico has been blighted by violence for many years, with successive governments failing to tackle the problem. According to the latest data available, more than 34,600 murders were registered last year, which is a record. President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador has promised to reduce the violence with a new strategy after taking power in December of 2018, but homicides have continued to rise in Mexico. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, September 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. West African leaders are meeting today, Monday, to consider a number of burning issues to the region.
It's a summit that will talk about the response to COVID-19 in Africa, and then the Mali issue will also come up.
We'll get analysis about U.S. sanctions on some ICC officials. Malawi's president announces measures to spark his country's economy. The WHO says it is unlikely that a safe, effective vaccine against COVID-19 will be available before the middle of next year. And Zambia's government refutes allegations it wants to arrest the main opposition leader.
We don't see any threat that can excite us to get locked up or things like that. What we need is a process, such as an inquiry, for example, where all those that have got facts about what transpired can come and give an account. And then, premised on that, decisions can be made.
And we'll tell you why some Christians in Cameroon are abandoning their church. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, are meeting today, Monday, in the Nigerian capital, Niamey. This will be the first face-to-face meeting since the onset of COVID-19 restrictions 6 months ago. At the conclusion of their last virtual summit on August 20th, the leaders told the military junta in Mali that they wanted a one-year transition to democratic rule. Monday's summit also comes as the weekend meeting between the junta and the leaders of the M5 protest movement got off to a rocky start. The military and the M5 want a transition process of 18 months, but they have yet to agree on who should head the transition period. Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
It's a summit that will talk about the response to COVID-19 in Africa. You know, Nigerian president was made the champion of COVID response in Africa.
So I understand that this summit is going to be the first face-to-face summit since the COVID-19. Why that?
You know that most countries in the region have started opening up. For instance, Nigeria opened to international air traffic on September 5th. And most other countries in the region are also opening up. And this summit specifically will take a special report on the response to COVID-19 in the region. You know, the Nigerian president at a special summit, an extraordinary summit held in April, was made a champion of the COVID-19 response in the sub-region. So it's going to give a report to the summit. And then the summit will also look at issues of the ECOWAS single currency, which has been on the table for quite a while. President Julius Maada Bio of Sierra Leone is going to present a report on that. There will also be a report on Economic Monetary Union of West Africa. That is represented by President Alassane Ouattara of Cote d'Ivoire. And then the Mali issue will also come up. The president of the ECOWAS Commission, Jean-Claude Kassi-Brou, will present a report on the activities of the body so far on Mali.
On the issue of Mali, it seems to mean that the military junta will not be able to meet ECOWAS's demand to present some transition program by the 7th of September.
Well, we do not know yet until that meeting comes. Maybe there will be a brief from the ECOWAS Special Envoy to Mali. Maybe there will be a briefing, and that's when the body of head of state and government can take a decision.
So you mentioned that international flights have started to arrive in Nigeria. Does this mean that COVID-19 is behind Nigeria?
Not exactly, because the Presidential Task Force of COVID-19 in its briefing on Thursday still warned that the worst was not over. We are not actually out of the woods, but Nigeria has decided to balance lives and livelihood. Keep safe, but livelihood should not suffer. If you continue to close your borders, airspace, People can't come in, people can't travel. Livelihood will be adversely affected.
Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. The Trump administration last week announced sanctions on International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor and Gambian-born Fatou Bensouda and the court's head of jurisdiction, Pakiso Muchochoko, originally from Lesotho. Umar Ba, an international relations expert and author of States of Justice, talked to Ricky Stryak about what the U.S. sanctions mean for the ICC and the significance of going after two of the court's African officials.
Most of the people who've been watching the ICC closely, the relation that the court has with the United States, especially since at the beginning of the Trump administration, are not really surprised about what happened. Now, this is an extreme measure. No one has gone this far ever against the ICC. Even previous administrations were also very critical and adversarial towards the court. It's not totally surprising, given that all the Trump administration has been saying, and the Bolton speech, I think it was, 2 years ago, when he said that the ICC is dead to us, and Pompeo himself had made a speech a few months ago, which had announced that they would be taking these actions towards the ICC.
What does this mean for the ICC's operations, and does this further delegitimize the U.S. on an international stage when it comes to the idea of international justice?
For the U.S., this is just one step further toward retreating from these international organizations and these global governance. For the ICC, this has also the potential of limiting its reach, its work, and this could actually have very serious effect on the ICC because, again, anyone who has dealing with these two individuals run the risk of being accused by the U.S. government of material assistance toward them and could themselves be sanctioned by the U.S. government. So this is definitely a very serious issue for the ICC. Now, that will also depend on how other states will respond to this, especially EU member states that are part of the ICC.
What do you think there is to say, if anything, about the fact that the two individuals they have targeted are Africans?
Yes, of course. The fact that the Trump administration has chosen two individuals that they targeted for these sanctions. One is Bensouda, who is from the Gambia, and one of her top aides, who is from Lesotho. Now, the interesting thing is that even if the Trump administration was only concerned with the Office of the Prosecutor, there are five top individuals in there. There's Bensouda, who is chief prosecutor, but her deputy prosecutor is a gentleman from Canada. And there are three top aides within her office. The fact is that two people were singled out, both from Africa, both black Africans, says a lot about what's the context of this. Because the other ones, Canadian, Italian, and Belgian, they're from citizens of states that are EU members. They are NATO allies. And of course, the Trump administration didn't want to go against these individuals. So they would pick the two targets that they do believe do not have a strong international support behind them.
That was Umar Ba, author of States of Justice. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Atlanta. Zambia's Interior Affairs Minister says President Edgar Lungu is not interested in arresting and locking up his political opponents to prevent them from contesting the 2021 presidential election. Stephen Kampiongo says the ruling Patriotic Front Party will defeat the leading opposition party without any difficulties. Last week, Hakainde Hichilema, leader of the main opposition United Party for National Development, the UPND, said President Lungu's government wanted to arrest him and later kill him to deprive him from participating in the 2021 election. Edith Nawakwe, former finance minister in the previous government, had alleged that Mr. Hichilema, as chairman of the Zambia Privatization Agency negotiating team, sold government enterprises that were slated for privatization to himself. Interior Affairs Minister Kampiongo accuses Hichilema of trafficking in lying against the government.
You may wish to know that this debate
was generated by Mr. Akande himself, because on several platforms where people have engaged him to seek for answers as to why he is such a rich man in Zambia, so he could share with the rest of the Zambian people and the entire world, just like many others, Aliko Dangote is able to give you a background of where he's coming from, where he is. Now, he has tried several times to dodge the actual questions, specifically to respond to how he generated wealth.
Mr. Minister, we spoke with the spokesperson for UPND. He claims that the finance, or the former finance minister, Ms. Nawakwe, was in charge, and that Mr. Hichilema was not.
Madam Nawakwe was minister responsible for finance, and she was not responsible. They had engaged Mr. Akande Hichilema as a negotiator, meaning he had to negotiate with possible buyers of these assets. What is alleged to have done in this case is that he knew that he had interest. These assets were estimated to cost about $26 million, okay? They were bidders who bidded to try and buy those assets. $20.1 million, there was a bidder who was about 18, and another one at 10, and the other bid was 5.2, somewhere like that, 5 point something million dollars. Now, it so happened that Mr. Hichilema and his team settled for this low bid, which they came to convince Edith Nawakwe that that bid was the most viable because the buyers were going to improve the facilities. Now, it didn't occur to Edith Nawakwe when she tried to argue, according to what she's saying, when she tried to argue with them to say, no, this is too low. What are we going to gain as government? That's when they explained that, no, the investment that will come into the property is much more better than the one who is offering $21 million, because these wants to come and clean the existing facilities, clean the carpets and beds and all that kind of thing. That's the impression they gave you. Now, the question which has arisen is that later on, as we speak now, Mr. Hichilema is one of the directors without declaring interest at that point to say he was interested in this, in the same assets.
UPND youth are saying that they will not allow the police to arrest their leader in any manner.
We are not preoccupied with getting him arrested. We would want to see a process, like I'm saying, that will create a platform for all those who have got facts about what transpired during the privatization program to have chance to give an account. Now, as to whether the UPND are saying they will not allow, no one is above the law.
Stephen Kampiongo, Zambia's Interior Affairs Minister, he was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bati in Washington. Today is Monday, September 7th. Malawi's President, Lazarus Chakwera, has announced plans to pull the country out of poverty, which he blamed on past governments. Chakwera proposed a series of reforms in his first State of the Nation address since being elected in June. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In his address to Parliament Friday, which ran more than an hour, President Lazarus Chakwera dismissed the notion that Malawi is a poor country.
You may have heard it said that Malawi is a poor country, but we must reject this lie. Surely, my country, with $85 million in gold exported to the Middle East every year, is not poor. My country, with a freshwater lake and multiple rivers capable of generating $100 million a year in revenue, is not poor.
Chakwera said the poverty which Malawi is renowned, however, is man-made.
Ours is a country stripped of its God-given wealth and potential by syndicates of people in the public sector who exploit decades of bad government policies and practices to enrich themselves at the expense of Malawians. In short, the poverty of our people is man-made, which means it can and must be unmade.
President Chakwera announced several reforms in various sectors, including three arms of government, the executive, judiciary, and legislature.
To reform the executive, we have embarked on a full-scale orientation of the public sector to the pillars of my Super High Five agenda: servant leadership, uniting Malawi, prospering together, ending corruption, and the rule of law. This will happen across the public sector over the next year.
In the agriculture sector, a lifeline in Malawi's economy, Chakwera announced the start of an affordable inputs program in which 4.3 million smallholder farmers will receive subsidized seeds and fertilizers. He said this will tremendously improve the level of productivity in the sector, which currently contributes 30% of the country's gross domestic product. Sherif Kaisi is a political science lecturer at Blantyre International University. He says it's time for President Chakwera to walk the talk.
If he's to live by his words, it means now it's time for work. No more promises. Malawians wants to see 1 million jobs, want to see universal subsidy of fertilizer, want to see trimming down of the costs of the passport. Those things which were already promised, and now they just live on those promises.
Bechani Cheleni, an economics lecturer at the University of Malawi, said Chakwera's speech was inspiring.
Well, the speech is it's giving some hope in the sense that the president has been able to explain to us why the economy is behaving as it is behaving now and what are the solutions. And because there are solutions, one would say that, yes, indeed, I think there's some hope that can come on the way.
Chelen says eyes are now on Chakwera's national budget, which his finance minister is expected to deliver during the sitting of parliament that begins Monday. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The World Health Organization says it is unlikely that a safe, effective vaccine against COVID-19 will be available for widespread use before the middle of next year. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Health officials are urging people to lower their expectations. They say the development of a safe, efficacious vaccine takes time and cannot be rushed. As it is, the World Health Organization reports remarkable progress is being made toward this end. It notes at least 6 to 9 candidate vaccines have begun phase 3 clinical trials. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says many thousands of people participate in these carefully crafted trials. She says a vaccine must be proven to be safe and seen to provide protection against the coronavirus in at least 50% of subjects before it can be approved for public use. She says the safety of the vaccine has to be monitored at all stages of the research, making this a lengthy process.
The good news is the manufacturers are already putting bets on which one's likely to be the vaccine, and they're already working out how they can scale up production of vaccines once we know which ones are the ones we will roll out. But in terms of realistic timelines, we're really not expecting to see widespread vaccination until the middle of next year.
Harris tells VOA that WHO does not tell governments when a vaccine should be made available for emergency or general use. She says that is a decision for countries to make for themselves. However, she cautions against raising false hopes about the prospect of an imminent vaccine that will vanquish the pandemic.
What we've been saying over and over is nobody should be sitting there waiting for the magic bullet, thinking that the vaccine is going to solve all this or that there'll be a wonder drug. What we have to do now is do the things we know suppress this virus. And those are the basics, the hand washing, the social distancing that we're doing, the mask wearing.
She says WHO believes all nations must work together in the search for a vaccine. She says sharing and comparing data is important and will result in a vaccine that protects everybody. Harris calls this a global public good. She says a vaccine not only is essential, but must be provided in all parts of the world, adding that unless everybody is protected, nobody is protected. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Some Christians in Cameroon are abandoning their church because they say their pastor is preaching that COVID-19 does not exist. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Song, When God Speaks, blasts through loudspeakers at Winners Chapel, a popular church in the Fuda neighborhood in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. The song, by the Nigerian gospel singer Frank Okochukwu Edwards, is played to welcome 23 new members. Among them is 37-year-old Annabella Tabot. Tabot says she left the Tabernacles of Freedom's ministries because her pastor deceived them, saying that COVID-19 did not exist. Tabot says the pastor asked her 60-year-old husband not to go to the hospital and was instead praying for healing from evil spirits.
His health condition kept on deteriorating and he finally died. Luckily, the government came in and isolated him and the other family members were not contaminated.
In August, Cameroon's government closed Tabernacles of Freedom's ministries for preaching that COVID-19 is a hoax. Many of its 300 members defied government orders and kept worshiping in front of the closed church. Tabot said more than 100 members left the church when her sick husband died shortly after he was suspected of having COVID-19 and forced to go to the hospital by the government. The Association of Pentecostal Churches in Yaoundé reported that at least 270 Christians left from six churches that preached against the existence of COVID-19. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Pomale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in East Africa, where Tanzanian champions Simba have named Barbara Gonzalez as chief executive officer, becoming the first ever female CEO in the country's top flight league. Gonzalez will fill the position left vacant by South African Senzo Mbatha, who left his position for arch rivals Young Afrikaans in a sensational move last month. The Confederation of African Football has expressed shock and dismay over the disappearance of a number of old trophies from the Egyptian Football Association, including an original African Cup of Nations. On Friday, the Egyptian Football Association announced that it had discovered the disappearance of some old trophies from its stores, affirming that it will investigate to locate them. The original African Cup of Nations trophies that the Pharaohs won in 2006, 2008, and 2010 are among the missing trophies. Staying with football news, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa have successfully retained the South African Premier Soccer League title, winning it for the 10th time in the club's history. The Brazilians, as they are popularly known, defeated Black Leapers 3-0 on Saturday to ensure their maximum points tally, thanks to a sensational hat-trick from Leboang Mbowe. Coach Pitso Mosimane was full of praises for his boys.
We had a lot of pressure outside and internal in the club, to be honest. People doubting me, but God is there for me. These boys made it possible. A lot of people didn't believe in the team. A lot of people didn't believe in me.
And on to athletics, where Kenya's Purity Jepchirchir on Saturday broke the women only world half marathon record after emerging victorious in the 2020 Prague half marathon in Czech Republic, clocking 1 hour, 5 minutes and 34 seconds to smash previous record of 1 hour, 6 minutes and 11 seconds set by Netsanet Gutera of Ethiopia at the World Half Marathon Championships in 2018.
I thank my God for the energy that he has given me. I am so happy. I'm proud. I was thinking maybe I could have run 64.50s, but yes, I am satisfied. It's difficult to run alone. Yeah. If I could have had pacemakers, I could have run 64.
In the men's category, another Kenyan, Kibuot Kandia, won the men's title after clocking 38 minutes and 37 seconds.
My wish is to run again when this pandemic is over, and it will be our pleasure to continue competing in the road races.
And finally, African representatives to the 2021 World Men's Handball Championship now know their opponents following the draw held at the weekend. The tournament will consist of 32 teams and is set to take place in Egypt next year, starting from the 14th to the 31st of January. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, September 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you